Earlier today, I taught you a little bit about dedicating your meditation to other people. Maybe we can also dedicate this chanting to other people. That's sort of what it's about may all beings be happy. So please follow along with us. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, peaceful and calm. Maybe you have found some peace today or earlier in the retreat. If you have, that gives you a little taste of what the Buddha was on about when he talked about the ending of suffering. The more peace there is, the more things start disappearing, the more suffering starts disappearing. And the deeper you go in your meditation, the less suffering there is. So I hope you found some of that peace, because that teaches you a little bit about what the Buddha called Nibbana, the end of suffering. But if you have not found any peace at all, then don't be upset, because then you have a chance to learn a lot about suffering. You can always learn something from life if you are open to it. Yeah? And so maybe your meditation is not going as well as you would have hoped. You came here with high expectations and now you feel like, it's all just restlessness, anxiety, anger, ill will, all those things the Buddha said we shouldn't do. I've got only that. Well, that's also good, because then you can learn about suffering. Because if our life and our mind was completely up to us, we just decide here and now, okay, I'm going to become enlightened because it's under my control. But it's not. Our mind follows patterns of nature. And so it's okay if sometimes, or maybe very often, I don't know, your mind doesn't behave. If it throws a tantrum, if it gets sleepy in meditation, if it gets restless and annoyed, then just laugh at your mind. This is just life, you know, and I'm part of it. And we're all part of it. So welcome to life if some things don't go your way. That's a very good attitude to have. One question per person, please. Oh, why? I can do like speed answering questions if I want to. You can ask multiple questions, but still, please be kind to Ajahn, it says on the bottom. Okay. When I run out of time, I'll just answer questions very quickly. Okay, here we go. Raffle again. From your perspective, it looks like I'm achieving something, but I'm actually just... pretty useless. Okay. Oh, this is a whole novel. Venerable Sunyo, thank you first for the spaceship meditation. Okay, now it has yet another name. It's not just, what was it again? Dragon Ball Z meditation, no? Okay, emptiness meditation, let's call it that. It was something new for me and quite exciting. I'd like to ask you about the Dighabu story in the sutta, where he made his revenge, in quotes, to the king who killed his parents and took his kingdom from him, not by just peacefully forgiving him and forgetting about the wrong, which sometimes seems like the main message that Ajahn Brahm gives when it comes to how to approach past hurt, but by making a deliberate point of how wrong the king was, by catching him unarmed and not hurting him when he could have. I know it's such an effort, too much to go into, but I wonder if we sometimes need an act to be able to honestly let go and forgive, move on from past misgivings. Thanks for your answer in advance. Wow, I have to read some more suttas because I can't remember that story, actually. Do you? Could be. I can't remember, but I can still talk about forgiveness. I hope you forgive me for not remembering that sutta. Okay, my favorite forgiveness story is of the angry crocodile. And you know it. I don't think you've all heard it before, so I will tell the story of the angry crocodile. There was, in India, a long, long time ago, you guessed it, an angry crocodile. The crocodile was always can you give me one of give me the monkey, was always biting all the other animals. The crocodile was living in the river, and all the animals needed to go to the river to drink. But the crocodile was always, get out of my river. You don't belong here. I'll bite you. I'll eat you. I'll eat you alive. So all the animals were very angry with the crocodile. All the giraffes, the hippopotamuses, what do you call them? I don't know. You know what I mean. Actually, in Dutch, you call them a Nile horse. Because they live in the river Nile, and they're like a sort of, they don't look like a horse at all, actually. Anyway, they got bitten by the angry crocodiles, and even the gorillas, the strongest of gorillas as well. Everybody really angry with the crocodile. But one day, the crocodile was sleeping, lying on his back. Got a friend here called Slavek, and I did this story in a retreat that I mentioned earlier, I believe, a retreat in Poland, and I made the translators do all the rah, rah, rah as well. And some of them, they didn't want to do it. That was really funny. But anyway, the crocodile, he did it. Rah, rah, rah. And he was asleep. And a little mouse walked up to the crocodile. Trippy, trippy, trap. And the mouse, would know what he did? Went right into the mouth of the crocodile while he was sleeping. And then the mouse put his little mousy hands around the crocodile's tooth. And he pulled it right out. And the crocodile woke up and he said, ah, thank you so much, little mouse. That tooth has been hurting for such a long time. And because it's been hurting, I've been so angry and annoyed with life and with all the animals. And that's why I was always biting you. And then all the animals suddenly realized the crocodile was only hurting them because he was hurting himself. Yeah. And from that day on, the crocodile no longer had a sore tooth. And he no longer eat any of the animals. He became a vegan. Yes, the first vegan crocodile in the world. And that was only because of the little mouse. And this story tells you, if people try to hurt you, it's only because they are not peaceful themselves. They are hurting themselves. Somebody like a Buddha would never intentionally hurt you in any way because they are not hurting themselves. And so they don't need to put their hurt into the world and put it onto others. So the way to forgive people is to realize this, yeah, that they are not out there just to hurt you. It's because they want to remove some of their own hurt in doing so. So that's a way to learn how to forgive people, with remembering the story of the now no longer angry crocodile. What would you say if one becomes restless, agitated and irritated by atheists? No, it can't be. Another's restlessness. Oh, yeah, okay. Sorry that sometimes I can't read words. That's only me. By another's restlessness during meditation, when they, for example, when they rustle, sigh heavily, or even accidentally kick a step on one's toe, kick or step on one's toe. It's not intentional, I know, but how do we react in peace?
just laugh at it, you know, somebody just steps at your toe, whatever. It's just funny. It's when I told you the story about the guy driving into our bins, also, it's just a silly person driving into the bins. I didn't get upset with that. Yeah, okay. People sigh. Well, if that's all the suffering you have today, people sighing, then you're pretty good life. Not a story. My father, he is a very sporty guy. And he has to travel for his work 20 kilometers one way and 20 kilometers back. And every day he goes by bike. Pretty cool, because even when it's raining, he still goes by bike. And when I was a little boy, me and my brother and my mother, at evening time, we would sit around the dinner table waiting for my father to come home. Yeah? So sometimes he would miss the ferry and he came a little bit late because he also had to cross like one of the canals we have in the Netherlands. He used to work in the port of Rotterdam. I'm from Rotterdam. So he had to cross the canal. And sometimes it was raining really, really heavily. And I felt so sorry for my father because he had to go all that way by bike. Yeah? And at that time I was a boy and I didn't really think that it was his own choice. I thought he was like forced to go by bike. He could have gone by car. I mean, he has a driver's license. But I didn't think, I thought he's forced to go by bike. Oh, so poor. Poor father. And he came home all wet. And he stepped on the doormat, all dripping with water. And I would often say, I'm so sorry for you, Dad. Aren't you cold? And don't you get annoyed by all the rain? And my father, without flinching, he would always say, most of the rain misses. Most of the rain misses. And if you get annoyed by rustles and sighs, then just think, most of the rain misses. By which I mean, many people in the world go through much more suffering than you are right now. People are in hospitals. People are losing their loved ones. And people are in war. Some of the countries, you'll not be able to do a retreat like this because it's just the whole country is in shatters. If you think like that, who cares about a little sigh or a little rustle or something like that? Who cares about your restless mind even? At least you have the opportunity to meditate, even though you might not always enjoy it. But most of the rain misses. Most of the suffering in the world doesn't happen to us. But often we feel like that, right? All of the suffering in the world, it feels like it's all yours. We always forget about all the other suffering in the world. And I often reflect like that when I feel restless or something happens to me. I'm like, this is just a little bit of rain that falls on me. But most of the rain, it misses. It's nothing to do with me. So that little bit of rain, I can deal with. Thank you, Venerable Sunyo, for this retreat's theme of finding peace. Oh, you maybe have to ask or thank Ajahn Brahm because he asked me what I was going to talk about, and then finding peace. sounded like a good idea. That's what I thought. I brought that up. Recently gone through a breakup, past. Breakup past. Is a breakup always in the past? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know what you mean by past. And coping with work-related anxiety, future. Oh, okay. I see what you mean. So you've gone through a breakup, so thoughts of the past and work-related anxiety, thoughts of the future. Is happiness externally driven, and or is my healing journey about finding inner joy? How do I bring myself to this present moment while I heal from the past and let go of the future? Yes. That's a good question. So happiness I used to practice in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition when I was a layperson. Some of you might know. And we used to also sing songs. Those monastics in that tradition also sing songs. We don't, luckily, because it would sound pretty bad, I'm pretty sure. But one of the song lyrics was, "Happiness is here and now. I have lost my worries. Nowhere to go, nothing to do, no longer in a hurry." Or something like that. And happiness is here and now. You can never find happiness in the future. Because when are you ever happy? In the past, in your life, when have you ever been happy? Always, right now. Never happy in the past, never happy in the future. So this is the only place where you can find happiness. Now, sometimes we find happiness in the wrong things, though. We are happy here, but we find happiness through excitement, for example, thinking about the future, being excited about things that we're going to do. Sometimes that can be okay, but sometimes it's the wrong kind of excitement. And instead of focusing on that sort of happiness, think maybe back in your life. When have you been most happy, most peaceful? Oh, I already give you the answer, actually. I was going to ask just, when do you feel most happy? And that is when you're most peaceful, I find, anyway. I have some of these memories from when I was a layperson, and I've got many good memories of meditation, but sometimes you have these very peaceful, happy moments outside of meditation. That you just, I remember just hiking through Scotland, for example, as a layperson, just having a little backpack with my tent in it, and I was just by myself, having nowhere to go, nothing to do. Well, I was hiking this trail, but who cared? I could just turn around if I wanted to or take the bus home anytime. But I was just there and walking through this beautiful forest, and I felt so light and so unburdened. The only burdens I had was to find a place to pitch my tent. That was it, because I had food with me and there was nothing else to worry about. So I felt really, really peaceful then, and I can still clearly recall especially those few moments that I felt really peaceful. Of course, I don't know if any of you have ever done that sort of hiking, but you're not peaceful all the time, because it's really struggling as well, and you get blisters and all that sort of stuff. But some of the moments I was really peaceful. And, well, one moment I was really not the opposite of peaceful. That was when I thought I'd take a shortcut, but it ended up going through this swamp area. So what you should do is also reflect on, when am I most happy? Is it when I'm worrying about the future, or when I am getting stuck in the past about this relationship? Why should you worry about those things? Relationship is over. Instead of reflecting on the sadness that it is over, maybe if you're a really strong person, you can reflect on the beautiful moments you have had in that relationship. Yeah? I told you yesterday that I was in a relationship and used to live together, and at some point it was over, we split up. Maybe I grieved for a week, and this is not because the relationship was bad, but I realized I have to move on. I also had some very good friends to help me through. And now I look back, I learned a lot from that relationship, and we had some very beautiful times. And maybe you can look at it like that. And concerning the future, I already told you, you can have all these plans about your work and stuff, but how many of those plans come through fruition? Almost none of them. It's best just to stay in the present moment. How do I prevent my shoulders and neck from hurting during or after long meditation? Do I have bad posture? Am I just too tense? Is this something that goes away with more time meditating? Are monastics just always in pain? With metta. Oh yeah, thanks for that metta. A little bit compassion please as well, because we are always in pain. No, we're not. I told you this, afternoon during the meditation session that my neck was in pain at the beginning. Right, remember that? And it didn't go away by trying to relax it. So then I realized, okay, it's no use trying to relax it right now. I'm just going to let it go and focus on my breath and forget about that pain. And then after the meditation, I came out again, focused on my body again. The pain was gone. And I felt really relaxed. So one way to deal with pain, if it just doesn't go away, is to do that, to be able to be not concerned with it, to have trust in your body that it'll figure itself out if you just let it be, if you just let it go, and let it sort itself out. Well, if you have troubles in your shoulder and neck after long meditations, it might be bad postures, but it could indeed also be maybe you're still a little bit too tense. You're maybe focusing with too much force on your breath or whatever you're doing. That could be the case. So try to just relax more. But also just realize, if I have hurting shoulders or neck, it doesn't stop me from meditating at all. I just told you this, what I did this afternoon. And I've done that so many times before. And being either in pain or in sickness, and just being able to just completely let it go. And meditation can be such a great tool for not only for pain, but for sickness as well. One time, I remember I was making some tea in my hut in Bodhinyana. And so I boiled the water, and I had the kettle of boiling water in one hand, and I don't know how I could be so stupid, but I tried to open the doorknob while I was holding the kettle. Whoever does that? Have you done that before? No. Don't try that at home, but or here. But I did that, and I boiled all the boiling water over my skin. Dukkha is what we say. So what I did, of course, first put it under the cold tap. It's for a while, because that's what you're told as a little kid already. So I, for a while, but of course, after a while under the tap, it still hurt. But what more can you do? You know, you cool it down, it still hurts. So what did I do? I thought, I'm a monk. I'm going to meditate on this pain. See what happens. Got nothing better to do anyway. And I didn't feel like drinking my tea anymore, so. So I just went to sit in my hut and just focus on that feeling. It really hurts, actually. I told myself it hurts. It hurts. Of course, when you pour boiling water on your hand, it hurts, right? And I told myself again, it hurts, it hurts. But then I thought, what if I tell myself that it doesn't hurt? What if I tell myself, this is a pleasant feeling? And I did it. I was like, I was already quite peaceful, so your mind is able to do that sort of stuff. And I was like, really nice. Yeah, nice boiling water on my hand. Feels really great. This feeling. Thank you, lovely feeling, for making me feel alive again. Or whatever. I didn't exactly do it like that. I did it more like quietly, you know, you reflect quietly. And that painful feeling, became one of the most beautiful feelings that I ever had. Physical feelings. Nice and tingly and interesting. And I realized it's just most of the pain was me telling it, telling myself that it was painful. So only a little bit of the pain, actually was no pain at all when I was able to convince myself that it was pleasant. Strange. I thought, this is really weird. This is maybe unhealthy, I don't know. So I went and told Ajahn Brahm about it. And he said, yeah, you change your perception of what it feels like. And that's possible to do. And I was finding it so interesting. I'm taking way too long again. Maybe I should put this back, actually, one question per person. So I found it interesting, so I went on to look up on the internet about pain. And I found this talk about a professor in Adelaide who studies pain. And don't go look it up during your retreat, but after your retreat, maybe you can find it. It's like a TED talk, and it's really, really funny as well. Can't remember his name now. Maybe I'll look it up and tell you tomorrow, but he told this story of how he was once hiking through the bush and he felt a little twig brush against the side of his leg. And he was like, okay, little twig on the side of my leg, who cares? So he went to take a swim and he got pulled out of the water because he got unconscious. Turned out he was bitten by a brown snake. Yeah, and if he knew he was bitten by a brown snake, he said, he would have been in agony. But because he didn't know, he thought it was just a twig, he didn't feel it. Years later, he went into the forest, was walking in the forest. The snake bit his leg. And he looked, and it was just a little twig brushing against. It's our perception, he explained, that makes much of the pain. So he does it like biological study, but he said, most of the pain is in the brain. It's not physical. It's what we make of it. So as meditators, we learn actually to see that kind of biological study is right. We can change our perceptions of pain. And maybe that's something you with your painful shoulders can do. Maybe they aren't painful, actually. Maybe they're really pleasant. Who knows? Give it a shot. Thanks, Ajahn, for your teaching so far. So far, okay. It might go downhill from here. They have been like a mild sedative. Okay. Relaxing, but not a cure. Right. Do you have anything stronger? Yeah, wait a second. Go deeper. Doctor's prescription. Do they use that here as well in Australia? Yeah. Go deeper in your meditation. That's where you'll find all the answers. You won't find them in my talks. Maybe I shouldn't say go deeper, but let it go deeper. Be able to let go more and more. And you ask for something stronger, and I haven't talked about the really deep meditation yet. I wasn't actually planning to do during this retreat. But when the mind goes really, really deep and it lets go of all the hindrances, even the most tiny hindrances, which is like your sense of self, the idea that you are doing the meditation, that you are watching something, if you let go of that as well, then you might be able to enter one of the deep meditations called the jhanas, and that is the prescription that I would give you. But I don't feel like talking too much about it now. I don't feel it's appropriate for this retreat right now anyway. What I should do and how to meditate if my mindfulness is very weak. I don't have so many thoughts, but a lot of sleepiness and drowsiness. Thank you. Yeah, that's often the case when we're sleepy and drowsy, then we're not really restless usually, so you don't have many thoughts, but it's also no mindfulness at all. I talked a little bit about sleepiness already, and maybe this question was put in the basket before that, but maybe do more walking meditation. Sometimes just sitting meditation, especially when you're already drowsy and sleepy, it's just can be a bit too boring, especially maybe when you don't meditate that often and you not really don't have the skill set yet to rouse energy during sitting meditation with your eyes closed. So maybe walk a bit more. I said before there, don't underestimate the power of walking meditation. Yeah, it's hard to fall asleep during walking meditation, so that's a very good way to try and prevent the sleepiness. I'll give you many other instructions before about sleepiness, so I'm just going to assume that that question was put in there before I talked about that, so I don't going to repeat myself too much. Hi Ajahn, my mother passed away last year. I still miss her a lot. I can understand that. I try to imagine she is still alive and live with me and talk to me. I want to know, how can I let go or move on? I know nothing is forever in the world. Everyone will die one day. But how am I to let go or move on? Thank you. Yeah, well, if you're Buddhist, you believe that this is not the only life we have, then you say, I imagine she is still alive, but she is still alive. Because Buddhists, we believe or know that there is rebirth and there is more than just a single life. So your mother is somewhere else right now, or maybe she's still around in like a higher form of life. And that, some people say, that's just, people just believe in rebirth to console themselves about death. But, well, that's not really the case for Buddhists, because the Buddha always said rebirth is suffering, so he didn't make it up just to console ourselves. But it does console us a little bit, because our loved ones still around. And that can already take away some of the grief. And also, it's a little bit the same as with that relationship breakup that I mentioned before. That person focuses only on the end of the relationship. But why do we focus only on the end of things? Yeah, I said, just reflect back on the relationships, on the beautiful times you've had. Yeah, and then you don't focus on the end of it, but just on the nice times. And it's the same with your mother or other loved ones. Just focus on the good times you've had together. When you go to a concert, you never just there just for the final note of a concert, right? I think Alan Watts said, if that was the case, then all the concertos would just be like finales with one of the slam of the cymbals, fling, done, and everybody applaud. No, you go to the concert to enjoy it while it's happening. And afterwards, when the concert is done, you're not going to cry, oh, it's over now. It's the same with lives of our loved ones. Yeah, it's life that people pass away. But we don't focus only on the end of their life, but on the lives we've had together. Some people never got to know their mother because maybe they passed away while giving birth or something like that. They never knew their father. You knew your mother, so you're very lucky in that regard. And I feel I can talk about this because I lost my brother when I was very young, but I still remember him. So I was taught about the reality of death very young. Maybe that's why it's never been too much of a problem for me. Also when I lost some dear friends, for example. This is the reality of life. And it's okay to grieve, but don't get stuck on it. Yeah, at some point you have to decide, okay, I've grieved enough. Now I will do my mother, I will make her more proud and happy if I move on now in life. If my mother would see me now, she wouldn't want me to be grieving so much. She would want me to be happy. In the Pali Canon, what is the most enlightened that a lay person attained? So there's stages of enlightenment not just in the Pali Canon, but in life. So it's not just like you're totally unenlightened and then you're suddenly fully enlightened. But there are stages. So it's like get a little bit more enlightened every time. I won't go into detail now, but most enlightened that a non-ordained person ever got was fully enlightened. And then a few days later, he got killed by a cow. So, from there came sort of the myth that if you don't ordain within a week as a lay person, if you get enlightened, you'll die. That's what it says in the commentaries. So, well, there might be some truth to it, in a way. Because when you're enlightened, you've done all the work you need to do. So the only thing left for you to do is to teach others and to share the Dhamma with others. And the best way to do that is as a monastic. So that's why enlightened lay people will take on the robes. Yes, so, but even in the time of the Buddha, enlightened lay people were actually very rare. And that one person that got killed by a cow is like an exception. Because most people, they already want to become monastics when they attain those earlier stages of enlightenment. And they already realize that the best thing for them to do in life is to put as much of their effort as they can into developing the path. Some of them still had like parents to take care of or children, so they didn't. But most of the others, they would put on the robes. That's what we get from the Pali Canon anyway. So believe from that what you will. But since you asked about the Pali Canon, that's what it says in there. I loved the emptiness meditation, and I'm glad you began with it. Could you please talk about what samadhi is and the path stages from present moment awareness to achieving samadhi, plus the differences between samadhi, enlightenment, and nirvana? Well, we'll be here a long time if we go through all of that. I presume we are trying to achieve this stage now, as in this incarnation. Do we aim to abide in one of the states? If so, at the time of death, to achieve a liberation from samsara? Sorry for the question. Don't be sorry. All questions are all right. It goes a little bit deep, but I mean deep as in beyond what I intended this retreat to be about. But if you are interested in that sort of stuff, I'll answer quickly. So from present moment awareness to achieving samadhi. Okay, let's take mindfulness of the breath as an example. I told you before how you start with your body, focus on your breath. Your breath becomes beautiful, and at some point, this is already quite advanced in meditation, so don't set yourself goals to achieve this pronto, but it will happen at one day, one point in time. Your mind starts to drop the whole body, even the breath starts to disappear. What's left is only the beautiful aspect of the breath, which is actually the mind itself. because I told you how the mind itself makes things beautiful. That's exactly why when I burnt my hand, I was able to make it feel beautiful, because it's not the body, it's in the mind. My mind was able to make it beautiful, feel beautiful. So the breath is also made beautiful by the mind. But then at some point, the breath itself disappears, and you're left just with that beauty, that happiness, we can say that. The Piti Sukha, the Buddha called it. When you stay with that happiness, the mind needs to somehow make sense of it, needs to have some sort of perception of it, and usually it turns it into a light. So you have these lights appearing in the mind that we call nimittas. It can also appear in different ways, like strange shapes that you might sort of like feel with the mind. It's hard to explain because we don't have language for this kind of stuff in ordinary English, because we always talk in the world of the five senses, but this all happens in the mind. Strange sounds might also happen, but it's all called nimitta. That means like a sign, and it's a sign that your mind is getting very deep. And when these nimittas happen, that's often when people get a lot afraid, because you realize you have to let go of a lot to go even deeper. And this is all described in the Anapanasati Sutta as well. You brighten the mind and you calm the mind. It means to make that nimitta even more beautiful, but also keep it calm at the same time. And if you're able to do that, at some point the nimitta grows bigger and bigger until it takes up your whole awareness, as it were. And if you let go, then the mind, the Buddha says, liberate the mind. But by that he means, in the Anapanasati Sutta, says liberating the mind. But by that he doesn't mean like liberated as in enlightenment, but liberated as in entering what we call the jhanas, this real deep samadhi. And that is the person's question earlier, who wanted to have something more strong. That's what I was talking about. The really deep meditations. And if you enter those, then you'll get a real taste of what it would be like to be a Buddha. Because your whole sense of self has gone, I saw it before. You don't have that sense of being the meditator anymore. You, whoever you think you are, is gone. And that is super peaceful, super nice. And that is when you can really get some insight into enlightenment. And enlightenment basically is having let go of the sense of self forever. Not just once in meditation, but no longer anymore. Is hope the same as being excited about the future? This is sort of like a semantic issue, you know. What does the word hope mean? What does mean being excited mean? Semantic means it's sort of like the meaning of words. But hope is often a little bit maybe different than excitement, because hope, you might feel like, I wish that something good is going to happen. And excitement, you might expect something good to happen. But in meditation, we let go of both, because they're both about the future. And we're just in the present moment. If you're happy in the present moment, no need to be excited about the future, because you're already happy. Why aim for the future? Why hope for the future if you're already happy here? The future, okay, I can't say this without laughing. The future is unpredictable. And the reason I can't say that without laughing is I once did a retreat when I was a layperson, a retreat in England, winter retreat it was. Oh, so peaceful. It's much better climate than here. There's snow on the ground. And I remember every morning I went to the kitchen and get the porridge that one of the people cooked, and then I walked back to the lay people's house through the snow. So quiet. Everything was quiet. But anyway, there was also this doctor from Italy staying there. And whenever something happened, let's say you spilled the porridge or whatever, he would always say, "Life is unpredictable."
So whenever I say life, I hear that voice in my head, life is unpredictable. I can't remember his name, but he was so kind. He took care of me. I got sick for a day or two, some food poisoning or something, and he took very good care of me. Life is unpredictable. And that's true. So you can hope for the future, but your hopes might not turn out the way you expect them to. Because life often doesn't go the way we plan, the way we hope, the way we are excited about it. Often something completely different happens. Who knows? We might not even make it to the end of this retreat. You're laughing, but not too long ago there was a retreat, and then there was a forest fire, and many other people had to leave. So, who knows? So therefore, use every moment you can. Who knows, it might be the last one. This question is for Venerable Ananda. Yeah. Read it out.
Can you levitate?
Sometimes I get a little freaked out in the Dhamma regarding the sense of urgency, endless samsara, endless rebirth, ghost realm and hell realms and the rest, and the need to get out. Be free of this. Please explain how to balance the practice of patience, kindness, softness on the background of this urgency, and might it be possible experience of coming in contact with the Dhamma in a human form? Oh, okay. Well, don't worry. If you are a practitioner of the Dhamma and you meditate and you keep your precepts decently well, you are one of the best human beings that is on this planet. So why worry about ghost realms and hell realms? You should actually be excited about the heaven realms. It's much more likely that you'll go there instead. Forget about all the lower realms. And then the Buddha said he was the teacher of gods and humans. By the way, I don't know if there's any non-Buddhists here who think all this rebirth stuff is the first time they ever hear of it. You've come to a Buddhist retreat, so you're going to get it. And yeah, be excited about going to heaven realm and then practicing further there. The Buddha said he was the teacher of gods and humans. So don't worry about the lower birth. And you have to take that urgency in a healthy way. Right? Okay, let's say there was a forest fire coming, just because I mentioned it. What is the first thing to do when a forest fire comes? I used to be like the fire warden in Bodhinyana Monastery, and when I gave my yearly fire talk, I always used to say, what's the first thing to do when a fire comes? Don't panic. When you panic, then things go wrong. You start running, and you trip, you fall, and if you fall in the forest while there's a fire, then you're really big bananas, big trouble, and you only make things worse. So, okay, of course there's a fire. You need to have a sense of urgency because you need to be prepared. And I don't want to say that you just sit there and, oh, whatever, forest fire, I don't care. No, you have to do something. You have to prepare to leave in the car, and then you'll be perfectly safe. There's no need to worry about forest fires over here. We're so close to the road. Nobody's going to be injured if we just act peacefully. But if we start rushing and start doing stupid stuff, then we create dangers. We start getting panicked. And it's the same with sense of urgency for practicing the Dhamma. Okay, have that sense of urgency, healthy urgency. But don't get panicky about it, because then you'll just
create all this worry, as you say. And what did you else did you say? Freaked out, you say. A little freaked out. Ah, then you're maybe a little bit too urgent, too panicked. So that's not healthy. That doesn't help. This approach is more like something you need to get away from, but without getting freaked out about it. And if you do that, you'll enjoy it as well. There my comparison with a forest fire sort of falls apart, because it's not nice to prepare for a forest fire, but meditation and finding peace is very enjoyable. And the more peace you find, and this is sort of the paradox, the more peace you find, the more happiness you find, the less urgency, in a sense, you'll also feel. And the less of a sense of self you have, the more you realize that suffering is also nothing to do with you. So enlightened beings, they don't care to suffer, because it's impersonal. So the further you get on the path, the less it also matters. Dear Venerable, any tips on how to let go of fear of death? Thank you. Oh, these are all deep questions. Let me see. Just something about meditation or something. How do you know you've reached enlightenment? Dear Bhante, please advise how to minimize the doing mind. Well, that's sort of the theme of this whole retreat. Minimize the doing and more knowing. And in that way you'll find more peace. And how to minimize the doing mind? Well, this is, again, a little bit of a paradox. You don't do the stopping of the doing. If you try to do the stopping of the doing, you'll be more doing. And so you'll just start more doing. And often we talk about letting go in meditation. I maybe not use the word that much myself, but in this retreat, but letting go. Stop the doing. And then people ask, but how do I do the letting go? But that is like an oxymoron. You can't do stopping of the doing. You'll have to find that switch inside to just... That's not even you. It just happens. It's not even you letting go. Letting go just happens. And the doing just settles and stops. And the way to get more skilled at that, to phrase it like that, is to experience it more and more. And also, this is very important, maybe that's something I haven't mentioned before, have trust in that as well. Have trust that letting go is a good thing to do. Have trust that if you stop the doing, only good will come from it. Because sometimes your mind might want to stop the doing, but it's fearful for you because you're so used to always being in control, right? Imagine you're sitting in your car and you better better keep hold of the steering wheel, otherwise you're going to crash into something, right? That's what it feels like in meditation sometimes. I better keep hold of this steering wheel so I make sure I go in the right direction in my meditation. Because if I let go of the steering wheel, of course my meditation will go bad. That's what it feels like. However, have you ever been to one of those children's theme park where they have these cars on a track and the children are playing with the wheel as if they control the car? And they believe it. But you stand there by the side and you're like, it doesn't matter what you do with the steering wheel. It's all on a track. You have no control. And that's what meditation is like. You think you're in control, but it's not. It's just on a track, and you're just there to enjoy the ride. So if you want to let go of the doing, have trust that if you're there to enjoy the ride, it'll be a beautiful ride. If you try and control it, then you will suffer on the ride. It won't be nice. Okay. More deep questions, sort of. Okay, I'll answer the one. Where is it? I can choose which questions I answer. Okay. I'll answer them all, I promise. There's not that many left, so you can put in more tomorrow. Don't worry, even if you already did one. I'll take this away again. About one question. How do you know that you've reached enlightenment? You as in impersonal, I don't think you're asking me personally, hopefully. How does one know that one's reached enlightenment? Again, as I said, many deep questions here, so I better get through them. The Buddha said many times he announced his enlightenment by saying he knew that he would not be reborn again. And that's how you know you reached enlightenment. You know for a fact that such a thing as rebirth exists, but you also know that for you, no more. For you, it's done. Show's over. No more ghost realms, hell realms, heaven realms, human realms, no more realms at all. And that's how you know. I talked about those earlier stages of enlightenment before, since people are apparently interested in that sort of stuff. I was, as I said, I was hoping to avoid it, but the first stage of enlightenment is what they call stream entry, when you enter the stream of the true Eightfold Path, the Eightfold Path towards enlightenment. And stream winners, they also know for a fact that there's rebirth, and they also know for a fact that it is going to end pretty soon. But they still might be reborn a couple more times, but pretty soon it's all going to be over. So they are, like the Buddha said, destined in the Dhamma. They are sure to get out of samsara, out of rebirth. And stream winners know that for sure. But enlightened ones, they know for sure that there's no more next lives at all. Okay, let's hope this one is more about meditation. Well, I don't mind this kind of question, but I'm maybe not in the spirit of the retreat too much. Or do you like these kind of questions? Who doesn't like them? Be honest. Who likes them? Put your hand up. Okay. Okay. Ah, okay. Well, just keep doing them then. I thought it would. The world of the senses is false and deceptive. I get that. I've seen the Matrix movie. Okay. Well, forget about the suttas and the Dhamma. Just watch the Matrix movie. However, like in the movie, the real world outside the sensual one seems bland, sad, lonely, and bleak. Not that inviting. Oh, no. I feel caught in the middle. The sensual world no longer satisfied, but I can't see the way forward to the much talked about in Buddhism joy of enlightenment, liberation, nibbana, whatever you want to call it. Question. Is it usual to feel this way on the path of practice? Will it pass? How do I move forwards? Well, it's very natural to feel that way because you feel it. I often get these questions, is it natural XYZ is happening to me? Of course it is. Otherwise you wouldn't be experiencing it. Everything you experience is natural. It's part of nature. And there have been so many people going before us on this path that everything that you experience on this path, somebody else will have had as well. It's actually surprising how different the questions are in this box. Other times, I've just got three times the same question after one another. Everybody asked the same question. So the feeling you have, others will have come before. So don't worry about it. So what was the other question? How do I move forwards? By finding joy in not just the meditation, but also the Buddha's path. If you are a devout Buddhist, which I sort of get from your story, then be happy that you found Buddhism. And find happiness in whatever way that you can practice this path. Not maybe only through meditation, but by keeping the precepts, practicing generosity, practicing kindness, and doing work for a Buddhist society, get involved with other Buddhists, and that sort of stuff. It's all very important. Make some spiritual friends as well, and in that way you can find happiness in, let's say, a little bit more worldly things than just meditation, but still very unworldly in the sense that they have all have to do with the Dhamma and all have to do with the path out of suffering. So the Buddha taught not just meditation, but if you read the suttas, many of the suttas are just about being good people and about practicing all these virtues of kindness, generosity, and then you'll just become more happy as a person and be more more of a bright person. And there's this story in the suttas as well, where one of the kings goes visit one of the monasteries, and he says, "Oh, I like going to this monastery because the monastics there are always smiling." And that's a really nice story, because some people think if you become a nun or a monk, you'll just be suffering. Like somebody asked, do monks just suffer? Right? Do monastics just suffer, was the question. But no, if you find a good monastery with good practicing monks and nuns, you'll find most of the time they're very happy. And that is because they live a beautiful life of simplicity and generosity as well. I mean, I don't have any money to share with anybody, but I practice generosity in my own ways, for example, by teaching. I could have said no when they asked me to teach retreat, and you would never find out, and I would be just sitting in my hut. But okay, I said yes, I'll teach retreat. And sometimes it's even helpful to uplift your mind when you feel like this, to reflect upon generosity, not just maybe your own, but also that of others. Do these kind of practices that uplift your mind. And maybe I'll tell you a little story just to end off, and many of you might have heard it before, because Ajahn Brahm often tells it during the retreat. But just to uplift your mind about the generosity of some people. The floor you're sitting on was made by the monks from Bodhinyana Monastery. I wasn't here yet at the time, but it was supposed to be done by the builders who built this place. Yeah, but the builders, just one day before it was supposed to be the grand opening of this meditation center, which was to start with a whole retreat and stuff. Just one day before, the builders, they got to here from there, or maybe the other way. I wasn't here, as I said. And then they said, "Toodle-a-dokey, we're gone. We're going to go home. It's too late. We can't finish it in time." And that night, the monks from Bodhinyana Monastery worked until 4 in the morning to lay this floor, like Ajahn Satuti, Ajahn Brahmali, and others, to finish the floor, just so the people could have a meditation retreat afterwards, and the hall was finished. Wow, that's pretty cool. They didn't get paid anything for it, right? And you will have done things as well, that you went out of your way to help other people, and reflect upon that, because it can be very uplifting, that sort of thing. I did put these up, by the way. And also a lot of the mulch that is outside. Nah, I put it there. Will you ever help me with the mulch? Okay, final story. It was a long time ago, actually. I think I was still a novice monk. And at some point, the work monk told me, Venerable Nibbuto, to put these huge piles of mulch that were sitting in front of the retreat manager's kuti, or the Ujjana Grove manager's kuti, or hut, the building. And they did big piles of mulch, and we had to put it, mulch is like the chopped wood stuff for people who might know. And then you had to put it in the wheelbarrow, drive it through the gardens, and spread it out in the gardens here, all the wood shreds. And for days and days, we were doing what we used to, by that point, we used to call mulch. Because we got so crazy of mulch that we are mulch. Oh, what are we doing today? Mulch. Day in, day out, mulch. Every day. And the piles just didn't seem to shrink. That's how big they were. Yeah? And I felt like overnight people just came back and put the mulch back on the pile. And after days and days of doing that, one day we got there and whole piles were gone. And they were all spread out. We went back to the monastery and asked, and Ajahn Brahm said, oh yeah, I just ordered one of those dozers to do it. We could have done that from the start, I was thinking. Why didn't you just order the dozer weeks ago? But now I realize I had a chance to practice generosity by spreading the mulch over here. Yeah. Now walk around here, I see many things I did. Like, one more story. Just good old times that I remember. And it's just, you're all laughing, so this is also uplifting to hear these kind of stories. Who of you live in the lower cottages? You might notice this embankment that goes with concrete on the top, with the railing to the side, goes down to the lower cottages. Yeah, it was me and other monks who put it there. And I'll never forget this, because I was the one with the angle grinding, to cut the metal for the poles or whatever, for the foundation. And suddenly, this other monk came up to me and just started hitting me. I was like, what is he doing? He said, your rope is on fire! Your rope is on fire! And it was this huge hole in my rope, burned right here. So you can imagine. You can imagine that I quickly had to find some new clothes. So I went away quickly to get some new robe, and I got back. And of course, just as I was away, Ajahn Brahm came to check on us. And he thought that I was like being lazy, you know, just not working there. He's like, where is Sunyo? And I said, my robe was on fire. And he said, yeah, practice like your robe is on fire. That's something the Buddha sort of said. Practice like your head is on fire, he said. So I'll leave you with that. I actually did pretty well today, you see. So don't worry about putting more questions in. We will, we'll be able to do that. Okay, let's all say three big sadhus for the Buddha and his teachings. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent.